Okay, just once more. If you are presenting a lightning talk, you need to be in the front couple of rows. Don't be way up the back where you have to run down, because I'll start the timer while you're running down. I am that cruel. If you run over, you will be hooked off. And don't think I won't use it. Okay, I'm going to be calling people up. If you've got slides and you haven't given them to me, you better be able to ad-lib because you're not getting them. Sorry. First off, the one exception we made to the slides, Flame's doing a live demo. He's sworn to me that it'll last less than 3 minutes. We have a big clock down here next to Elizabeth. You can hopefully see. She's little. Otherwise, she'll have to move her head. No. Naughty. Okay. After Flame, Martin Kraft is next, followed by Paul Waper. Please make sure you're ready to go. I'm going to let people know what the next two are. So if you're a speaker, you will be ready. Ready, set, begin.
Okay, what I'm going to do today is create a database-driven web application. Normally this presentation would take about 45 seconds. It may take a little bit longer this time because I don't have my regular assistant. Elizabeth Garby has kindly volunteered to operate the mouse for me. Okay, this is a demonstration of Applix Development Studio. It's a web-based rapid application development studio. Okay, so if we begin by creating a form, and then we'll go to the data tab. We add a data source, so just click on data source and put it on the form, add a data control, add, let's say we add three data fields, just hit the close, hit close on that. Slight technical error. Okay, so add two more of those. Okay, now double click on the data source, which is the one up the top, and it asks you to select a database. So select a database, select a query, and then click on the data control to link it, and then click on each of the data fields and just select name for the first one, and then select phone, and then select email for the last one. How much time have we got left? Oh, okay. In that case, do you want to group select those three boxes? So just using the mouse, group select. So just drag it around them. Just hold the button down and drag around them. Okay, that'll do. Yep, and then just Control L. Okay, now just hit the Save button in the top left-hand corner, and then hit the Play button. Okay, if you just hit the forward arrow.
Okay, we're going to have a quick moment while we just switch over the video cable.
Does anybody want a noodle soup? I guarantee it's unpoisoned. I will prove it to you if you take it. We got it for free. Please eat it. We just ate one. It was good. No one in this room wants a noodle soup. Who of you was first?
Do we have any ex-hackers in the room? Why won't this work talk to the external video? Come on, someone from X, let's make it work.
My kids need support. You have 3 minutes, Steve. Go do it. Go do it.
And he will do it.
Hurrah! Okay, there's your space bar if you need it.
Thanks.
Next up, we've got Martin Kraft. After that, Paul Waper, followed by Stephen Ellis. Make sure you're ready, kids.
So I'm going to talk to you about my PhD research, which is in progress. I'm doing that at the University of Limerick in Ireland and studying the Debian project, but I think that it applies to pretty much all of open source. My research question, and also further information because I only wanted to have one additional slide, is what are the factors which lead to adoption or rejection of tools by Debian or open source software developers at large? Now, I'm motivated to do this because I'm a member of the Debian project and I look at our workflows, which have, for the past 14, almost 15 years, evolved without ever really being rethought or scaling properly to the fact that we have about 20,000 packages in our archive. I think we could be doing a lot more with the manpower that we have available. I think we could be increasing our efficiency. And since we are all a group of volunteers, I don't think the way to do that is by stepping in there and saying, this is how you're going to do it. We will use Git from now on, and that kind of thing. It's not going to happen. If you know the Debian project, you will have to agree. So I want to figure out what it is that actually makes someone adopt Git versus Mercurial, or Mercurial versus Git, and put all of that into a framework so that I can use this framework later on to determine... I have so much time left. So that I can use this framework later on to determine whether a given tool has a chance of being adopted by open source developers. Now, this can actually then be used by developers of any tools in order to improve their tools and cater them for developers. So if you are the author of a version control system or a way to improve Debian packaging, you can use this framework to figure out where you can best spend your time to make your tool as successful as possible. And I think I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay, next up we have Paul Waper. Where's the stupid mouse? Oh, you didn't have slides. Nope. Excellent. There's just the mic.
Right. A couple of years ago, I bought a laptop, as most people do, and got it on the website. They had this really neat thing. It looked like it was cherry red on the website, and I got it. There were two problems. One, it was sort of more a maroonish brown, and two, it was made of plastic. And I'm a woodworker. I thought I can do better than that. So I built a press out of MDF. I built a set of metal pieces that would actually hold onto the edges of the laptop, and that cost about $100. Bought some veneer that cost about $70. I made a test run, and that didn't work so well because I measured the inside of the plastic case and made that the outside of what I was making, which was bad. It was 5 millimeters too short, and that's not good enough. So you throw the first one away, right? So I got a second bit of I got my nice walnut fiddleback veneer. I remeasured everything. I tested it against the original plastic case. I glued it together, and here it is. There are two things that I discovered when I put this together. One was that if you're going to do this and you're going to pull it out of the mold while it's still feeling a little damp, make sure it dries out on something that is absolutely flat. Right? Because that does not hold onto a laptop case. The other part is that the metal bits inside it tend to slip around when you're gluing three pieces of wood together, and it's not quite at the stage where it will hold onto a case. So, things I learned: use a better glue, one that actually sticks to stainless steel. Glue the layers together separately and only wet the bit of the wood on the edge to get it to bend that around the edge of the form, rather than wetting the whole thing and having it warp on you. And the next one is the real, real good one, so we'll see how that goes. Thank you.
Personally, I look at a wooden laptop case and think, fire hazard! Okay, after Stephen, we have Marco Ostini and Mikko, I couldn't quite read your handwriting, Lebanon, I think. And yes, you want to fire up your slides?
Okay, first a big thank you to Anthony for highlighting one of the issues I want to talk about, which is why we're not seeing mainstream adoption, particularly on the desktop, because a lot of the applications don't work as well as we need, or we're not reporting all the bugs. If we live with the problems that affect us at the moment, how are we supposed to expect mainstream adoption of Linux, especially on the desktop? So get out there, report the bugs, help us fix the bugs, please. But if we want to prevent next year's LCA or the year after being a sea of Macs, because that's what we're all switching to for our desktop, we need to fix media. Media is no longer optional on the desktop, it's no longer optional on Linux. It has to be there and it has to work out of the box. It's a big deal, and it's a big deal for the distributors because at the moment they can't provide this in their distributions legally without looking at bundling commercial codecs. We want this in FOSS, we want it to work, and we want it to work for the latest and greatest, and that includes Blu-ray, HD, DVD. And these are the companies that can hopefully make this happen because they've got a vested interest in making Linux work. And they're all members of the Linux Foundation. And there's a great deal of companies here today who are members of the Linux Foundation. So can you please go back and tell your bosses, boss, all the way up the food chain, you need to keep making Linux work. And to do that, we need patent-free, royalty-free access to do these codecs in FOSS. And we need it now.
Is Marco here?
Didn't say please.
Please? There you go. Did you have slides?
Yes, mm-hmm. Just the one.
Right. Which one are you up to?
That one. Where's the mic?
There you go.
I didn't know I could have more than one slide.
We lied.
Yeah, thanks. Alrighty, my name is Marco Ostini, and I'm here to talk briefly about the Linux Australia members in Second Life blog. In Second Life, my avatar's name is Dante Jens Laszlo, which is what I post on the blog as well. And essentially, the blog is, it exists because of a bunch of members, a members group that exists in Second Life, and it's essentially Linux Australia people working within Second Life to show people in Second Life the goodness of free and open source software, and to also encourage Linux people like yourself to get into Second Life, because it is actually the most open of the metaverses that exist. And it's easily influenceable. We've already influenced it quite considerably already. And we can easily make sure, I mean, the viewer is already covered by a GPL license. The server backend will be released under a GPL license as well. It hasn't so far, but it's on the way. All right. We provide tutorials on the blog, including, and in particular, how to easily install Second Life on a dev package-based Linux box, because some people find it's a little bit of a hassle to get it set up and going. You do need a reasonably decent graphics card. That's probably the one thing to consider. All right. There will be tutorials coming about how to use free and open source software tools like GIMP and Audacity and QAbimator to build stuff in Second Life, and so that you can actually do things within the world and be creative without having to resort to commercial software. We're looking for LA members to join us to do that. So, you know, that includes the whole lot of you. And there already are some of us now, but more's always better. Including people who post on the blog as well, if you're interested. One of the ideas that we would like to work on is to build a massive virtual OLPC XO people can walk inside and work out how the thing, you know, see how it works and the clever bits of it, like the LCD screen and stuff like that. And when we're finished, I know, 30 seconds. When we're finished, we'll have a space within Second Life that we can host LUGs to have virtual meetings there, simulcast with your real meetings for those who are distance challenged, so that, you know, they can still attend your LUG, but do it through Second Life. So actually to use it not just as a something to talk about, but something practical to the community. And I'm finished. I'd like to hand over to Mikko and say thank you to Nokia for this magnificent N800. Which kept my timing accurate to 3 minutes.
Well done. Okay, Mikko, are you here?
I am here.
Okay.
Thank you.
After Mikko, we have Avi and then Jeff.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mikko Leppänen from Finland, Nokia. And I was basically asked here to tell you what internet tablets are by Marco Foremost. And I have one also in my back pocket. And it's actually really simple. It's somewhat of a secret, but it's actually a laptop that just happens to turn on really fast and so on.
Does it suspend and resume?
Actually, it's magic. It just doesn't consume any power when you close it. It's a very useful addition to your normal compile farm, although it's somewhat limited on power, or computing power, but it is the perfect control node. And actually, you all already have internet tablets. It's there. It's the backpack that is sitting next to you underneath the seat. It's the laptop. It's the extra battery. It's the third extra battery. And the extension cord that you probably kind of wish that you could connect somewhere right now. Mobile computing, that's basically it. Kind of, you can run SSH. That was the key thing for many people. I don't know why. It actually has Xterm installed by default. That is only so that the care people can check up on what's wrong with it, for me to check what kernel version it's running with. You name. 2.6.21-OMAP1. Yeah. I still have no time. Okay. I'll tell you. I have this idea since laptops are getting smaller, the time that you can actually use them, it's getting actually larger, but the time slots that users actually use them are shorter. But once everybody has a laptop with them, you can use it to check tomorrow's weather instead of extrapolating from current weather. That's what all of you here already do. So you know what the computing of future will be, just without the extension cord. Thank you.
Next up is Avi Miller, after that is Jeff, then Ron Skiok. And I'm sorry if I mangle anyone's names, your handwriting all sucks. You all should type more and write less.
Okay, I'm here to talk about CodeSniffer, which is one of the first tools released by Squiz. CodeSniffer is a PHP 5 development tool to enforce coding standards. It is available through Pear and comes pre-installed with the Pear Zen framework and Squiz coding standards built in. A coding standard is a series of sniffs, and each sniff goes out and checks for a particular coding requirement. For example, how long and how indented your arrays are, which is the one I always get wrong. Developers create new coding standards by modifying the installed sniffs into new packages or creating your own sniffs. So far, we've had over 20 developers provide additional sniffs to CodeSniffer, including the Zend and Pear guys. We built it because we've spent the last 8 years developing very large PHP applications, and we go through developers because they burn out after about 3 years, so we have to replace them. So we need consistent code. If you look at the Squiz code base, all the code is identical because you have to pass CodeSniffer's baby brother Snoopy for our Matrix product and CodeSniffer for our MySource 4 product before it will go into our CVS and SVN repositories. Other projects like Pear run it every night. So every night Pear runs CodeSniffer across all of the Pear packages. And there's a view as to who is good and who is bad at maintaining coding standards. Who uses it? Squiz use it, Pear use it, Zend and the Zend framework and Seagull guys use it. And we've had about 500 Pear installs per month since it went up. So we know quite a few people do use it. We have integration with things like JEdit on Linux, Windows, and Mac OS. TextMate, we have a bundle for TextMate, so you can run CodeSniffer from inside those two. CVS and SVN on-commit checks, so you can prevent your code from being committed if it doesn't pass. We have Thing cruise control and PHP under control modules for checking. We have Zend Code Analyzer, has it built in. And CodeSniffer itself will export CSV, XML, and check style report formats. Whew. What we want, guys, we want you to use it, we want you to test it, and we want you to provide us with bugs and new sniffs via the Pear Bug Tracker. Thank you.
Okay, next up is someone who probably doesn't need much introduction. Let's see. I pre-started this because I didn't want to have to wait for OpenOffice to actually fire up. That seems unfair of his out of his entire presentation if it's all spent waiting for OpenOffice to load. So here's Jeff.
It's the first conference I've ever used OpenOffice Impress, and I'm going back. In the GNOME project, we have an underlying passion and an underlying principle. That is that software freedom is not just for geeks. It's not just for those of us in this room. It's for our moms. It's for everyone out there who is not a geek. Software freedom is crucially important to all of those people as well. The only problem is that computers are stupid. Or, correction, people who program computers are stupid, or have been for many years. And so computers do things computers kind of way. Everyone knows what WIMP is. It's windows, icons, menus, and pointers. Stop clapping, I only have 3 minutes. The only problem is that when I get up in the morning, I don't feel like resorting my icons and shuffling my windows. That's not what I care about. What I care about and what normal human beings care about, and that includes all of us in this room, are people, events, documents, conversations, and, of course, getting laid. Everyone knows that people who write enterprise software don't get laid. People who write software that human beings want to use do get laid. So that's the whole point. We write software so that people can go and get laid. Getting laid? What the crap is all that about? Well, what I want to talk to you about today is couple-aware software. I decided to get a Flickr account, and I decided to upgrade to a Flickr Pro account, but I was very disappointed that it would mean that either Pia or I would have to choose who would get a Pro account. I won that time, but it would be ideal if Flickr knew that we were a couple and we could have a combined Pro account so that we could do our photos together. We share our photos with our friends. Often enough, we do it as a couple, and we want to be able to live in the digital world as we do in the analog world. Facebook almost gets it right. Everyone knows about your relationship status, you know, engaged, married, complicated, etc. Thankfully, when I suggested to Pia digitally that we should get married a number of years after we actually got married, she accepted, and so we're listed on Facebook as married. It's often kind of alarming when you realize that friends are no longer in a relationship when you just see it scrolling by on Facebook. And of course, couple-aware software, software that socially understands the construct of a couple, leads to family-aware software. Do it for Pia, who is not pregnant, just to make it clear, again.
You are that one. just get an arrow, is he?
Use the mouse button. Okay, after Ron, is Pia with a response to Jeff's getting laid, I'm sure. And after Pia will be Simon Lyle, so if you can be ready. And actually, yeah, if you can come over here when you're next or the one after that, that'd be even better. We can keep this really moving.
I don't know how I did this, but I'm wedged between Jeff getting laid and Pia. So I'm not sure what's going on. I'd like to announce the two projects that we're in the middle of, and we're doing something very open source. We're not actually releasing until it's a finished project that we've actually got commercially working. The first is NB Bag, which is a full group of Thank you. Okay.
There we go.
Right. Okay, so it's an application glue. In many ways, it can be compared with some of the larger packages. We like to look at it this way. It's a combination of GDK, OpenOffice, Postgres, and using Xterm displays for all local and remote users. All our external documents are produced through OpenOffice. Full printing options, and this is then being used into a business full open business accounts package. We're currently converting one client base at about $1.8 billion. Hopefully that will complete this month, which will mean we're on target to deliver a full converted and operating solution. It's accounting tied up with project risk and all the management processes. So it's quite a complex solution. We've been stuffing this market up since about 82. When we sold our first system, the real thing back in Adelaide, we said we're going to open source it, and then we looked at our code, and I won't tell you what's going on, but we may make the fourth or fifth quarter this year for our release. That's one of those exercises. The role of McGippy is to be a solid commercial accounting package, which will be fully open sourced, but it does fit into a marketing and business thing. This is one of the project master screens. As you can see, it's all GDK driven, photo driven. You'll notice risk to do management, incoming management, all that is part of the project focused approach. We've got full risk management to Australian standards, very extensive security controls, and thank you all very much.
Okay, next up is Pia Waugh, I believe. Did I get it right? Yes, I did. And she doesn't have any talks.
After that is Simon, and then after that is Shane Owenby. So if you can be ready.
Hi everybody. First of all, who has one of these? Okay, put your hands down. Who wants one? Okay, no. I don't have any more to give away, but I do have some good news. Who here knows of a school or a child in need that could really use one of these? Only a few of you. Oh, open your eyes. I'm actually helping establish a new project called OLPC Australia. OLPC Australia has three primary goals, or three aims. First of all, to get OLPCs into the hands of disadvantaged communities and kids in Australia, including remote and rural communities. Second of all, to get OLPCs into the hands of every kid in primary school in Australia. And third of all, to help get OLPCs into the hands of needy kids across Oceania, so Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Islands. The current board is, and it's only just being established, it's not completely public knowledge, but I wanted to tell you guys about it because there's a couple of things I think you might be able to be interested in. So it's being brought together by some representatives from the United Nations Youth Association, from Jeff and I are getting involved, Jimmy Rogers, who's already involved deeply with OLPC and a whole bunch of other stuff. We're going to have an advisory board, which is going to have representation from community, education, government, and we're going to have a development subcommittee. So this is why I'm telling you guys about it now. We're going to be doing trials in Australia, and so anyone that knows schools that might be interested in this should get in contact. Anyone that knows people that might know people that might be interested should get in contact. We're going to be having a development subcommittee which will have funding to do projects, that's education projects, localization, technical software. So anyone interested in doing software or anything on the OLPC should get in contact with ideas and such. We do have a domain, we don't yet have a website, but it's going to be olpc.org.au or laptop.org.au, and we should have something up in the next couple of weeks so you can get in contact. And the four primary functions of OLPC Australia are going to be procurement. So any of you that actually want to purchase them, we're actually going to be selling them in small bundles. We won't be probably doing one, but we might do bundles of five or six, or that will be determined. But you'll definitely be able to purchase them here locally in Australia for cheaper than what's currently not even really available in the US here. And we'll also, so there's a procurement function, we'll also be doing development function and working with lots of people to do that. Thirdly, we're going to have a support function ranging from peer-to-peer support right through to commercial support. And how much? My God, what are you telling me? And fourth of all, we're going to have a community development function as well, really trying to build an enthusiast community, development community, and support community around this, including getting businesses involved for support. Thank you all very much. If anyone's interested, please contact me, Google me, or find us on olpc.org.au in about 2 weeks.
Seems very proactive for Jeff and Pear to be thinking about the future children, I have to say. Yeah.
Sure. There's space to advance.
Yep.
Okay, this is Simon Lyle. After Simon, we have Shane and then Rusty.
Hey.
Okay, I'm going to talk about an idea I have to fix speech recognition under Linux. Currently, if you're using Windows or Macintosh, speech recognition pretty much works. You can use Dragon via Voice, one of Microsoft's products, and you can pretty much unplug the keyboard and interact with it all day long. Under Linux, you have academic software, a bit of abandonware projects, and basically you can't do that. The reason I see for the gap is twofold. A, the problem is really hard. People are doing speech recognition for 20 years, no solution. Two, the attempted solutions so far under Linux have been monolithic, big, single projects trying to do anything. So my idea is to break the problem into parts, and the analogy I use is a bit like email. Under email, you have your email client, you have your MTA, you have list software, you have virus software, spam software, all these sort of things, and they perform separate functions. There's alternatives for each function, and they're all communicating together using standard protocols. So here's roughly how I see doing it. You'll have a desktop client plugged into your microphone. Now the client will know your voice, know your accent, know what you typically talk about, and that will be the gateway to the other applications on your desktop. In turn, it forwards all the connections to a server, fairly simple, TCP, handles streams and all that sort of stuff. Now the interesting bit is the worker. Now what you have is a series of workers handling the whole function. The first might clean up the sound, next worker splits up the words, then guesses the words based on the previous, one does the actual recognition. You might have other cute little tricks like lip reading from a camera, so on and so on. Now, the protocol you need to work it across a network. So if you want, you can outsource your entire speech recognition to Google and they can just record every word you ever say. You need to have metadata. So if all your application's asking for is a yes or a no, that's all you need to do to recognition. Plus you need to put in all that data about your accent and all that sort of thing. Currently, this is just vaporware. I just thought of this a year ago. I do not have the resources or the ability to do this myself. If you're interested, I've got it a bit more fleshed out in places. Come talk to me. Thank you.
Just a request from the AV team for the speakers. Can you make sure you hold the mic up about here, just so that they don't have to keep fiddling with the volume? Thanks. Okay, next up, we have Shane. You had no slides. Excellent.
No slides. I'll put the microphone in my mouth. Is that all right?
Yeah. Bet you can't get the whole thing in there.
For that, you can reset my timer. Okay, I'm here to clarify some thought about what Oracle's doing with open source and Linux specifically. So I run the Linux and open source team. I speak fast, so my 3 minutes should be used effectively. Number one, I've been talking to a lot of you. I've been here all week, and a lot of you don't understand what we are doing, what we're not doing. So number one, instead of inventing our own distribution, we took Red Hat Enterprise Linux, took the logos, took the copyrights out, and invested in upstream support. You've seen Zach Brennan and some of the other engineers presenting here, and also in back-end support. Okay, number one, freely downloadable. So anyone could argue that it's more open than Enterprise Linux because you can download it for free. More importantly, look in your delegate bag, you will see a DVD. Okay, also, Oracle VM is freely downloadable as well. First virtualization environment that is used for free and supported with Oracle running in a guest environment. It is Xen running on top of Linux. Okay, geez, that went by way faster than I had planned. a number of other things is that, you know, the fact is we are abiding by the community rules. We are doing things upstream. We're not hiding things behind the firewall. So, you know, when you take a look at what Oracle's doing around open source, it'd be very clear that we're following the appropriate rules. In the kernel report, you would see that we're actually making a number of contributions to that area based on the statistics that are there. So, if you have any questions, here for the rest of the day. Happy to talk to you. Cheers.
Okay, next up we have Rusty, who apparently doesn't have slides either.
No, because then it won't talk again.
Not my problem.
Hello. Oh yeah, threads. Okay. I hate threads. Are there any questions? So, let
how
me. How
much do you hate threads?
How much do I hate threads? Let me explain. So, sometimes it's something that you want to do asynchronously, so you decide what I really need here is a thread. I have a programmer who went through exactly this. He died. I'm sure that's not coincidence. So what you do is basically you have a little part of your program that does the thready part and you hand stuff off to it. Except now you're back in the DOS days of programming and you're sharing everything, even stuff that's completely irrelevant. Even better, things like memory allocation start slowing down because now you need locks so that if you both try to allocate memory at the same time because you're sharing everything, now your software needs to actually manually protect you from the other threads that are sharing your address space. Okay, now I did some research and it turns out that sometime during the 60s, they invented this hardware thing called page protection. Yes, thank you, PMU. Okay, so unbelievably, this thing exists in most modern hardware. If only there was some way of utilizing this hardware to replace the software that we use to keep the threads off each other. Now, I call this project Assisted Native Technology Implementation of Threads, or Anti-Threads. It only has one bug. It doesn't exist yet. But I have a header. And every time before I do a lightning talk, I spend 5 more minutes on writing the implementation. This is the third lightning talk, I think, that I've given on libAntiThread. So it's now 15 minutes into development. It is almost finished. So come up and talk to me about libAntiThread if you're interested. I'm sure we're immediately ready for massive deployment and a huge increase in the developer base. Cheers.
After Mary, by the way, we have, sorry, I'm getting a bit confused here, Tim Anstall and then Grant Grundler. Again, apologies, your handwriting all sucks if I've misspelled you or...
Okay, I actually wrote a blog post on this about a year and a half ago. It's the top Google hit for getting a talk into linux.conf.au. I wrote a blog post on this about a year and a half ago, so you should know about it already. If you don't, this is about not what animals to put in your slides, but what talks you should maybe or possibly or please submit to linux.conf.au. Quick stats, you can see at the bottom, we don't accept very much stuff. We say no to an awful lot of people. Some of them ask us why, and we're a bit puzzled for an explanation, usually because it's your stuff wasn't as good as the stuff we selected. All right. So, one of the reasons we get a lot of stuff, a lot of submissions, is that people get free admission, some of them get free plane flights, and a lot of them get free accommodation. So this will be a guide. If that motivates you to develop open source software, I guess that's good. So this is a guide on how to successfully convince us to give you a trip to Australia. Okay, we've got three icons. I had to develop two of these myself. Sad things, don't get in. Meh things, still don't get in. Only happy things get into LCA. Okay. So, a sad type of talk to submit is something along the lines of why a particular project is really cool and interesting, and I know a lot about that and want to tell you because I've used it a couple of times. Okay, don't submit those. Something that, well, okay, you might think that what might get in is why a particular project is awesome and I know because I developed every last line of it. The reason that doesn't get in is because for very large projects we get those talks every year. We get, you know, the state of Samba, the state of libfoo, that sort of thing. Okay, the reason why I've deployed it on approximately the number of atoms of the universe, give or take 10 to the 20, the reason why that would get in is we don't get enough sysadmin talks. Submit those. And also, finally, you can submit your Samba talk if you are Trich. Okay, sad thing, stuff that nobody has used yet. It has to be really cool, and string parsing libraries and a number of other things, almost everything you can think of is not cool. So if you don't have people using it yet and you're not cool, don't submit your talk. The next one, the next meta one, okay, is a little unfair. We might, sorry, 30 seconds? We'd probably accept this from Rusty, you know, give or take. But we get a lot of kernel talks, and about a million of them are really, really good. So unless you are better than all of those really, really good people, well, you can submit your talk, but we'll probably say no. We don't get a lot of KDE. If you're doing KDE, do that. If you're doing GUI design, we don't get a lot of that, submit those. Okay, and this, I think, would be the best single talk at LCA ever.
I really, really want to see that talk. If you can write it between now and the end of the lightning talk session, Jeff, I'll put you on one last slot. Okay, next up we have Tim Amstel. This rubbishy little mouse. It's not the Microsoft one this time.
Everybody, put your hands up.
Just one hand up. Just one hand up. Come on, all you people at the back, I can see you. Hands up. Put your hand down if you're not in Australia. You don't reside in Australia. Put your hand down if you don't have a blog. Put your hand down if you're not on planetlinux.org. Okay, you people who have hands up, submit your blog to planetlinux.org.au. Okay, I don't know how to speak. You get the idea. Submit your blogs. Open Day. I'm running the gaming miniconf stand at Open Day, and I still need helpers. If you want to stand around and tell people about cool open source gaming projects, come and talk to me. On another note, if you're interested in running the gaming miniconf next year, come and talk to me too. I've done it twice and I'd really like some sucker to do it next year. Finally, this is my open source project. It's been around for about 6 years now. I started in 2001. We've just released. We released on Tuesday at 12 8:35 at night before the gaming miniconf. So we support Windows, Mac, Linux. Come and check us out. If you've checked us out previously and gone, oh, we look kind of crappy, we look a lot better now. It's a turn-based strategy game framework. So things like Stars, Reach for the Stars, VGA Planets, Civilization in Space, anything like that. So come and check us out. We have swag. If you want to buy swag but don't want to pay shipping, I have swag here. Come talk to me. That's all.
After Grant is Val Henson. Oh, I don't have any slides for you. Excellent.
I don't have slides.
Brilliant.
And if I did have slides, I'd probably have to have a corporate lawyer look them over first. So that's just better that way. So I work for Google on the platforms team. I'm a Linux kernel developer. I've been doing I/O stuff for I don't know, since 1980 something, when I was hacking Apple IIe bits going on a floppy drive. It was fun. Yep. Thank you. And what I want to talk a little bit about is about latency. And this is an item that I've been working on for about the past year at Google. So when you go to Gmail and you click on your email and it takes more than 1/3 of a second to come up, odds are it's either the network or the disk. Okay? And between your application and that disk, there's about 4 layers of stuff that I want to just quickly touch on to tell you what the complications are. The first top layer for the people who are not in kernel development is the file system. This is what basically does your block allocation, and Val can correct me on her next talk if she likes. There's probably a lot more to it, but that's the fundamental thing. And because it tells you where to put the blocks on disk, it also controls the access patterns. So it sort of says this is how you're going to put data on those disks. The next layer below that is the block layer, and that block layer is what sort of reorders things to make it a little bit more optimal where the file system got it wrong, and or there's multiple threads, multiple users. And what you can have is, if you have a lot of I/O, you end up with long queues, and if you have no way of getting around that queue, again, you'll have the same problem of very long latency because you're waiting for all this other work to be done first. And I forgot to mention one thing at the beginning. So the latency, the way Google works is we have a lot of hardware. And we have a lot of hardware because we want to guarantee that latency. The result is we have very poor utilization, and I'm trying to improve that and reduce the power footprint that Google has for the number of users. So I didn't make that point clear. I hope I do now. Okay, block layer is done. The next layer is drivers. How am I doing on time? Excellent. Drivers. Drivers are actually not that bad. Drivers, there's only one issue that I can think of offhand that drivers cause a lot of latency, and that is interrupt coalescing. It's an obscure way of reducing the CPU utilization. It tries to limit the number of times that the I/O device has to tell the CPU, I'm done. You can have my I/O now. Okay? Okay, last thing here is devices. So we buy a lot of devices from a lot of different vendors. And all of those devices are small computers. They are very, very complicated. They have a lot of firmware on them. And so some of that, a fair chunk of the latency that you guys see is because the firmware went off and is doing something else. It does not care about your I/O for that particular moment in time. And I have some interesting slides back at Google. And? 10 seconds? Good. And device firmware, that's good enough. Environmental issues are the other one, vibration and stuff like that. Thank you.
Okay, Val's next, Arjun Lentz is after that, then Marcus Brown, if you can be ready to go.
Thank you, that will probably help. Hi, I'm Val Henson, and this conference, I'm going to talk about stupid buffer cache tricks. This conference, I was watching Dave Chinner's talk about speeding up XFS repair, and I thought, I did something like that for EXT3. Maybe I should have talked about that. But actually, there's only one interesting part of doing this for EXT3 FST file system check, because it's entirely I/O bound. We had no issues with CPU. I mean, I'd love to have it be CPU bound. That's never going to happen. So what I ended up having to do is solving this problem, which many, I'm not sure how many people run into, because I had a hard time finding the way to do it. So I needed to do asynchronous parallel, non-sequential, block device read-ahead on systems that already exist. So I can't go do something fancy in the kernel and have them reinstall it. So I started out with some fairly advanced knowledge, which was that Linux asynchronous I/O is not asynchronous. Okay, so I got that out of the way, saved me some time. I went and did the whole lot of threads implementation, where you have a whole lot of threads and they do synchronous I/O, and that's extremely irritating and sucked and went not very fast. So what I finally came up with was this totally bizarre POSIX F-advise thing, where I said, hey, you know what, I'm going to want to read this at some point. When I actually do want to read it, I call read. And when I'm done with it, I say, I am done with this thing. Please throw it away out of the cache. So as Dave will tell you, the problem with just like randomly doing read ahead as fast as you can is that if you do too much, it falls out of the cache, and you end up just reading everything twice, which is shockingly twice as slow. So so the other thing I had to implement using pthread mutex locks is internal counters for both the size of the cache, the amount of cache I'm using. Oh, by the way, the buffer cache, it keeps things that you've read for a while. So I don't have to keep them inside of my memory and pass them around. In fact, that would have been bad because it would have been double buffered. Anyway, so I just sort of like had to say, you know what, I think there's a buffer cache out there. And I think I put in this much stuff, and I think it has this much in it. Okay, now I can put more in. You can't see it at all. So, and the other thing I had to track is how many IOs were outstanding to in this read-ahead system, so it wouldn't just, the POSIX F-advise stuff, so it wouldn't just throw them away and ignore my requests. So, I think this sucked. It's not even really asynchronous IO, because I have to do the caching bit. I'm managing the cache. Here's the code I wrote to do it. It's you know, like, I don't know, 1,000 lines or something like that. Maybe comments are 4,000 lines. Take a look at it and tell me if you have any ideas or you already know how to do this, because that's what I would love. Okay, thanks.
See, I should have had a helper here operating this just to save a bit of time, but oh well, we live and learn. So, where is Arjun?
Howdy. So I built a self-replicating hopping robot. No, I'm hopeful I could get a talk in that way. That'd be excellent. So this is not at all about me. This is about Cyrek. Who's visited Cyrek yesterday at the? Yes. Who has no idea what Cyrek is? Okay. Very, very quickly. First computer in Australia. Fourth in the world. Now this is interesting. In 1999. One of the people who used to, at nighttime, play with the thing, built an emulator. It was built in Delphi, and it's not open source. Now, we could probably convince them to open source that, but it's a bit useless. Full specs are available. The mnemonic instruction set is available. Programming manual is available. Sample input and output is available. Will some of you please do some homework and just build an open source emulator? Please. Thank you. Not quite. Yes, I still have 2 minutes. I don't need 2 minutes. I can do better than this. Okay. I've been trying... Well, you have 2 minutes to finish it, yes. I know that some people have been playing with it. I want to see more. The thing has some displays. You want to get a nice emulation. But of course, we want to display this. So I've been wrangling some hardware vendors. The best we can do so far, and this is really, really good, is we can probably make this work on an OOPC. Wouldn't it be nice, Cyrek OOPC? Open platform, right? Jim Getty said, we can probably get you one. Of course, Melbourne Machine needs to accept it. We'll need to work on that. I'm sure we can make that happen. You make the code, we make the rest happen. Thank you.
Okay, next up we have Marcus Brown. Again, sorry about this. Mice. I'm sure there's got to be a way of making this thing just like work without suck, but oh well. Over to Marcus. After Marcus, by the way, we'll have Janet Porter and then Paul Fenwick. Sorry, after Marcus, we have Janet and then, oh, this is off. Yeah, hang on. I suck. After Marcus, we have Janet and then we have Paul Fenwick as the last two.
Hi all. I had no idea how to speak in public, so it's very boring. Please feel welcome to fall asleep. This little project is all about basically installing Linux to a removable card. Having heard a few talks this week about projects using minimal installs, I thought I'd mention it to you just to see if you're interested. Written as a card boot installer for Familiar Linux, which is usually distributed in packages containing file system images and JFS2 images for Flash. Most of the users couldn't understand the wiki for some reason, so there were heaps of questions on the mailing list about some simple tool to install to a card. After a few people were told, look, it's so simple, you do it 5 lines on a command line, it then appeared that the major problem was that most of them were using Windows workstations or didn't have a workstation whatsoever, they only had a PDA. So a 5-line script became 5,000 lines wrapped into a mini distro, and we had to use heaps and heaps of stupid little hacks. One of the problems was we're using all different types of machines all the time. They have different resolutions, different abilities. The only common thing about all of them was that they were ARM5 chips, so that made it a little bit easier from a build perspective. What you can see here is the main menu after it's booted up. By the way, the whole thing is based on a gzipped initial RAM disk of about 3.5 meg, which decompressed during boot by a monolithic kernel, no modules involved whatsoever, no modules in the file system. Opens up to a 12 meg, or roughly about 12 meg system, package installer, drop bear, the whole thing. Well, now the stupid hack part of the whole thing. You've got there install menu, tests, you can do kernel testing, you can do all sorts of weird things, see if the machine's broken, all that sort of thing, without throwing away that other little OS that we won't mention. Does all sorts of various things. One of the nice little hacks here is the graphics. This is just a colour frame buffer console, so you can't really, there's no graphics libraries. This is done by taking a dump of the frame buffer straight to a file, cutting it up with my favourite graphics editor, which is DD. and then throwing it straight back onto the frame buffer when you need to, and then painting the graphics over the top of it. Same thing with the audio play. That's it. Nice little hack. Hope you're interested. Thank you.
I'm so happy we haven't had anyone go over yet. I haven't had to use the hook. I'm actually not entirely sure how structurally sound it is. I do, however, have super glue all over my fingers, and they smell of acetone. So, you know. Okay, next up we have Janet, and then I think the last one was Paul Fenwick. Where's Janet? Here? Excellent. One less. Paul. You have 3 minutes and about 18,000 slides, I notice.
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, everyone.
Drum roll, boys and girls.
Can everybody hear me okay? Wonderful. Everyone, today I'm talking about fixing the web. Some of you might know this already. This is fundamentally a talk about taste. Now, back in the 1970s, if you're in Weight Watchers, we hoped that you liked red cabbage and jello, because that were on the recommended slides of what you should be eating. But that's not my taste. My taste is different. So when I was in primary school, I didn't think very much of this particular painting. Instead, I thought this painting was much better, which I drew. Likewise, I didn't think very much of this document, and I thought that a much better document was this one here, which I wrote myself. And by the time I got to high school, things weren't much better. So So one of the great things about being an open source is we can fix things. And one of the great things about having physical objects is we can fix things as well. We've been doing a lot of hardware hacking this week. So if you've got a program you don't like or a public space you don't like, you can fix it to your taste. That's fantastic. But can we do that with the web? Well, we can. There's this cool plugin called Grease Monkey. Some of you might be using this. Those of you who aren't, I'm speaking to you about this in this talk. Grease Monkey lets you run JavaScript on any page you want. JavaScript which you write, which is fantastic. So let's go and fix a web page, make it better. Now, I've only got 3 minutes, so I can't do this quite live. Which web page are we going to suck? Are we going to fix? One that sucks. Which web page sucks the most? That's right, MySpace. I struggle to find any redeeming features on MySpace, but some of my friends have their blogs there. So if I go to MySpace, I get something which looks like this, of which I care about almost nothing. To fix MySpace, I'm going to use a little bit of JavaScript. What this lets you do is you pass it an ID, it tells it to go away. Now, how do you find those element IDs? Well, you can look inside the HTML source, but if you've ever looked at HTML source of MySpace, it's pretty scary. So, I'm going to use another tool called Firebug, which is another Firefox plugin. Yes, which some of you have used, it's awesome. Firebug's got an inspect mode, you wave over something on the top right there, you can see down the bottom, there's the HTML, nicely formatted, the element which is responsible. So you can use that element. I'm smiling for the camera, that didn't work. So, once you've found all those elements, you can then remove all those things you don't like. And if you go to MySpace without this plugin, it looks like this. If you turn on Grease Monkey and install the code I've written, it looks like that. And if you've already logged in, it looks like that. So you can do anything you want with Grease Monkey and Firebug, but most people are lazy. They don't really want to write code themselves. So if you want to have something cool, like a plugin which lets you see all the different book prices when you go to Amazon, you can go to userscripts.org, which is a huge repository. You can see there, MySpace for unsocial fascist bastards. That one's mine. More than 14,000 scripts on that site. So everyone, go fix the web. Thank you.
I think we do have some prizes to give out. We'll be giving them out in a while for the lightning talks. I think by popular acclaim, I might be able to pick which one was the most popular. Such a cheap shot. I'm ashamed of you, Paul, making cheap jokes in a talk. Anyway.